melancholy or counting the beads on their abacus of disappointment. They could take care of you with delicate and effortless ease. At 5:20 in the morning, my sleep was very deep, occasionally punctuated by the usual barnyard assortment of snorts and sighs that most people my age begin to make. But Joe was lying wide awake beside me then, when the telephone rang. Later, when telling the story to friends, he would revise the events of the night, putting himself in the role of an innocent sleeper startled awake by the phone. In this idealized version, the phone rang and he sat up in bed, disoriented.
"What? What?"
And his hand reached out and grabbed for the phone, knocking over a glass of water. When he eventually spoke into the receiver, it was in a mush-mouthed, unprepared voice, and I, beside him, was supposed to have gasped and embraced him when I heard the news.
"Oh, Joe, Joe, you've worked so hard for this."
And then we both began to cry. He had to tell it this way. Otherwise, he would have seemed too eager, like someone who had been confident that the call from Finland really would arrive this time. The truth was that Joe reached for the phone in one swift movement, knocking over nothing. His voice was strong when he said hello. The connection was infused with a crackle and the slightest quality that suggested both voices were trapped in a time delay tunnel. A foreign man spoke, his tone both meek and hearty at once. He asked for Mr. Kesselman.
"Mr. Josef Kesselman?"
he specified, and then he told him the news. Joe swallowed, felt his chest expand with an aching pride that seemed a troubling, distant relative of heart attacks. He pressed his palm flat against his heart, shushing it.
"Can my wife Joan get on the extension?"
Joe asked Tuva Hallinen, the acting president of the Finnish Academy of Letters.
"I think she should hear this, too."
"Of course," the Finn said.
By this time I was sitting up in bed and staring at Joe with wild eyes, my own heart going nuts, chemicals flooding into me from every port, and I scuttled down the hall in my nightgown to pick up the phone in what used to be Susanna's room. "Hello?" I said into my daughter's pink princess phone.
"This is Joan Kesselman."
I sat on her bed, beneath the bookshelf with its ancient, pristine sets of Nancy Drews and Trixie Beldens.
"Hello, Joan. That is Mrs. Kesselman. I am hearing that you wish to be part of this conversation,"
said Mr. Hallinen.
"Well, your husband is our choice for this year's prize."
I gasped.
"Whoa," I said. "Oh, oh my God.
He is a wonderful writer," continued Hallinen calmly, "who deserves these accolades. We are honored to have had the opportunity to choose this gentleman, for we find his work to have been heartbreakingly beautiful and important over the years. His career has a great span to it. He has grown in stature, and it has been a pleasure to observe. Each book is increasingly mature. I must say, my personal favorite is Pantomime, for, in many ways, the characters of Lewis and Margaret Strickler remind me of myself and my wife Pippa. So fallible. So human. You should know," he went on, "that later today, Mrs. Kesselman, you shall be fending off the press."
"I'm not a movie star, Mr. Hallinen," said Joe from the other extension. "I'm a fiction writer, and that's not very big in the States anymore. People have much bigger things to worry about now."
"But the Helsinki Prize is important," Hallinen said. "We know it's not the Nobel, of course," he added obligatorily with a self-conscious and revealing laugh. "But still everyone gets excited. You will see."
He went on to explain more details, including the breathtaking prize money and the visit to Helsinki that Joe would be making.
"We expect you to come too, Mrs. Kesselman, of course," he added quickly.
This week there would be an official interview done at the house, and next week a photographer would do a formal sitting with Joe, in preparation for our trip to Finland.
"But I recognize that we have awakened you," Hallinen continued,
and I shall let you get back to sleep now. The undersecretary from our offices shall be in contact with you later today." He must have known, of course, that no one ever went back to sleep after receiving this call. We all said goodbye like old friends, and when we had hung up, I ran into our bedroom, throwing myself down beside Joe on the bed.
"Oh, my God, this is it now," I said. "You were right. You were right. I feel like fainting, like vomiting."
"I didn't know I'd be right," Joe leaned against me.
"This is the beginning of a new phase, Joan."
"Yes, the insufferable phase," I said. He was silent, ignoring that. "What should I do?" he asked after a moment.
"What do you mean, what should you do?"
"What should I do?" he repeated, childlike. "Call Lev," I said. "He'll tell you what he did. He'll give you tips on everything. He'll walk you through it step by step, how you deal with it. But basically, I think you do what you've always done. It'll be the same, but bigger."
"Thank you, Joan," he said to me quietly.
"No, don't say that. Don't start. I don't think I could take it."
"But I have to say something," he said.
"There's nothing new to say," I told him. "And please, no matter what happens, don't even think about thanking me when you get up on that stage in that gigantic hall or whatever it is in Helsinki."
"But I have to," he said. "It's what everyone does." "I don't want to be the long-suffering wife," I said sharply. "You can understand that, can't you? I mean, come on, Joe. Think about how you'd feel."
"Can we worry about that later?" he asked.
"Yeah," I said. "I suppose we can."
He kissed me hard on the mouth, and we both tasted the vinegar of sleep. Then he did the strangest thing. He slowly got up and stood on the bed, towering unsteadily in the room, looking down from this new angle. The room was tilted but still ordinary. Joe Castleman knew he was special, though not so special that he could avoid the things of everyday life. They surrounded him, as they always had. Yet now, he knew, he could pay less attention to them. He could let himself exist in another world, a parallel dimension where big-time prize winners lay on chaise, eating figs in the sun, and thinking of nothing but themselves. He would have to fight that impulse, keep himself from getting soft. He'd have to keep publishing, keep his output strong and constant. "What are you doing up there?" I asked now, peering up at him as he stood on the bed.
"I want to jump," he said, "like the kids used to."
I thought of David and Susanna and Alice and the way their small bodies had shot up into the air, pajamas flapping, shrieks of pleasure accompanying each jump. Why did children love to jump? Was there actual pleasure to be found in the up and down of childhood? The bed, the playground swing, the seesaw, as opposed to the blindly determined in and out of adulthood?
"Come on," he said, "jump with me."
"For joy?" I asked, not smiling.
"Maybe,"
Joe said, though he must have known that joy was not exactly here right now in this bedroom at dawn, with the sun discreetly poking into the windows, illuminating both our faces, pointing out the similarities between men and women that age creates, the androgynous tempering and etching. What was here was something else. Something exciting, but maybe a little bit too exciting, too stimulating, so that it blurred the sensations, reducing the possibility of joy until it dwindled down to nothing.
"Jump with me," he said again.
"No," I said, "I don't want to."
"Oh, come on, Joni."
It was a name he hadn't called me in a very long time, and he understood that the siren call of it would have an effect. It did. Despite myself, it roused something in me. I was an idiot to be taken in again and again by him, wasn't I? To celebrate him. To sing him.
but I couldn't find it in me to be any other way. It took a moment, but finally I brought myself to a wobbly standing position on the bed. "This is extremely weird," I warned. We faced each other, bouncing lightly. We certainly didn't feel the kind of freedom our kids had once felt, the simplicity of bodies inhabiting undefined space, and I reflexively crossed my arms over my chest so my breasts didn't swing up from under my nightgown and sock me in the chin. I tested the mattress, getting used to the give of it, its trampoline possibilities. Despite everything, there was some pleasure here, no matter how self-conscious. It lightly stirred the air as we started to jump. Soon the telephone would be ringing all the time, as it would always be for him or about him. So what else was new? I was used to that by now. Joe had been famous for a very long time, and there is an inevitable uniformity to fame, regardless of its level or quality, whether it's the TV kind with its feral, laser-bleached teeth, or the political kind with its puffed hair and cufflinks, or Joe's kind, the rumpled sweater and the perennial drink gripped in a fat hand. Soon the round of interviews and congratulations would start. Soon it would be too much for me to bear. As the days passed, I began to see that. I wasn't going to handle this well. It would inflame me with the worst kind of envy. It would leave me all alone in my unadorned wifely state. Soon he would gloat and preen and discuss his triumph non-stop, inflated with ecstasy and self-importance. Soon it would be intolerable. And soon, too, we'd be on an airplane, this airplane now, lowering slowly through the clouds into an unlikely pocket of Scandinavia and into the end of everything between us. But for one moment on the bed, Joe and I were fine, entirely the same, our ridiculous late-life selves in crumpled pajamas, briefly lifting off above the earth before finally settling back down. Chapter 2. It kills me to say it, but I was his student when we met. There we were in 1956, a typical couple. Joe intense and focused and tweedy, me a fluttering budgie circling him again and again. Even our clothing is an embarrassment, at least seen from the Olympian vantage point that time provides. His suede elbow patches that attempted to transform a Brooklyn Jew into Mr. Chips. And my long plaid skirts and flats, which I wore because he was short and I was tall. The last thing I wanted to do was scare him away. There was no danger of that. He wasn't scared of me. He was extraordinarily confident and dedicated. He pursued me and I responded, just the way other students and their professors were doing all around the country, engaging in steamy little couplings that were pleasurable and infuriating and grossly imbalanced. I felt honored to have been chosen by him, and relieved too, for it lifted me out of the prolonged stupor that seemed to have infected the entire student body of Smith College in 1956. This wasn't strictly our fault. Though many of the girls in my dormitory chattered like castanets about getting married right after college and buying homes in places like Old Lyme, Connecticut, Chauncey Foster had already decided which one she wanted, a sprawling Tudor with a goldfish-stocked pond, though she had not yet selected a husband. We were not all silly or empty or unaware. There was an intense knot of imperious political girls in my dormitory, and while I liked them and felt excited when they got fired up at dinner, I wasn't one of them. Though filled with my own opinions and information, I was too soft-spoken, too mild. I was an English major with a side interest in socialism, though on a campus comprised of vines and porch swings and dinner rolls, this interest was almost impossible to sustain, for everything here was washed in a golden female light. None of us was in the thick of anything. In 1956, we understood that we were being kept separate from the world that mattered. The world of single-minded, odious men on Senate subcommittees with their big microphones and their slicked-back hair. And men in hotel rooms with their pressing needs. We were being preserved for some other purpose, willingly suspending ourselves like specimens of auger for 4 years. When Joe first arrived at Smith that fall, he was stunned by the sheer volume of femaleness, something he hadn't experienced since he'd lived among women in Brooklyn. But this, of course, was different. This was young and freshly showered. This was dewy and waiting and extremely responsive. This was the female equivalent of a prison full of men, all of whom would know it the moment a woman entered the prison gates. She would be palpably sensed. She would be felt through some kind of bloodhound radar. As she swished on through, the entire prison population would tremble as one. Which is exactly what we did when Joe walked into the classroom in Seeley Hall, 17 minutes late, on the first day of classes that September. Girls were everywhere in his view, of course. He could just as easily have plucked another one from a life of term papers, field hockey, and Saturday night mixers. But instead, he plucked me. And up I went, whoosh, without any resistance at all. The other girls were ubiquitous, chattering, equally pluckable. Though they were also more patient, taking their sweet time at everything they did. A bathroom door in my dormitory would swing open to reveal a girl with a naked leg up on the sink, a razor traveling leisurely up a field of foam. They crossed the Smith campus in clusters, these girls, as though they might simply tip over if forced to stand alone. The air was congested with the scents of three dominant perfumes that joined together like distant strains of pollen, giving the whole place the quality of some sort of nectar bar. The men we usually had access to weren't men at all, really. I understood that they were a rehearsal version, a softer, less demanding breed than what we'd eventually have to contend with. And they too were hidden far away on their own gated campuses until the weekends, when they would suddenly burst into town with their baby faces and thick necks, leaping out of their cars like soldiers on leave, following the zigzag trail of pollen, and carrying some of us off to local bars or dances or beds. At age 19, I wanted nothing to do with these boyish, slightly illegitimate men. After a couple of evenings spent in their company, drinking foamy tropical drinks shaded by tiny umbrellas, eating steak and foil-wrapped potatoes, and talking dully about our post-college plans or about Army McCarthy, or about whether Judge Kaufman had been too tough on those poor, sallow-faced Rosenbergs. Absolutely not, the date usually said, with a fist down on the tabletop and the grim, sorrowful conviction he'd probably picked up from his father. I decided, enough. No more drinks. No more putting on pearls or fluffy cardigans. No more staring oh-mouthed into a mirror as I applied Taste of Xanadu lip color. No more being met in the parlor of my dormitory by a galumphing boy with an outsized Adam's apple. No more grasping. No more breasts perennially being popped from the shells of brassiere cups in the darkness of that same boy's car. No more letting his wet and hopeful dog-like face land on those breasts. For if I kept doing those things I knew, then I would become tinier and less substantial, of no real interest to anyone, male or female. And when I finally had access to the world, it wouldn't want me. I've always had a fear of being small and
ordinary.
How can I just have this one life? I used to ask my mother incredulously when I was 12 and sat at the dining room table in our apartment in New York after school, eating a cruller. I'd delicately chew the whirls of fried dough and try to look into the windows of other apartments across the double width of Park Avenue. My mother, an angular, worried woman whose life was spent serving on committees to organize charity dinner dances at the Pierre and the Waldorf, didn't really know what I was talking about. And my sudden spasms of nascent existentialism always made her anxious.
"Joan, why do you say such things?"
she usually said before drifting into another room. By the time I was in college, I was desperate to have a big effect, to tower over people, to loom, which seemed a completely unlikely possibility in the occasional moments when I saw what I'd become, a slender, hygienic Smith girl who didn't know much about anything and had no idea of how to learn. English 202, Elements of Creative Writing, was held in the late afternoon on Mondays and Wednesdays. I'd heard that the class had previously been taught by a Mrs. Dimphna Worrell, who'd published flower poems. One Sprig of Freesia, The Bud That Wouldn't Bloom, in a publication put out by the New England Horticultural Society, and who sat sucking lozenges and praising everyone's work in the same sweeping way. Expressive use of language. But now, Mrs. Worrell had retired to a rest home in nearby Chicopee, and none of us knew anything about her replacement except his name, which the course catalog listed as Mr. J. Castleman, M.A. I enrolled in the class not because I imagined I was talented, but because I wished I was. Though, really, I'd never tested it out, for fear I would be told I was average. There were 12 students in English 202, and after we'd arrived at the seminar room in Seeley Hall on the first day of class and chatted blandly for several minutes while opening our notebooks to fresh, hopeful pages, the entire classroom fell into a worried silence. Whoever J. Castleman, M.A. was, he was late. But when he swung into the classroom at 17 minutes past the hour, I wasn't prepared for him. None of us was. He was in his mid-20s and skinny, with uncombed black hair and high color stippling his cheeks. He was definitely handsome, but seemed to have been constructed in a slapdash manner, and his books were loosely held together by a strap, giving him the appearance of a frantic schoolboy. Professor Castleman walked with a slight limp, a hesitant scraping of one foot before it lifted off the floor. "Sorry," he said to the class, popping open the clip that held everything together and releasing a burst of his belongings onto the surface of the wide, glossy table. He took from his coat pockets two handfuls of walnuts in their shell. Then he looked up and said, "But I sort of have a good excuse. My wife had a baby last night." I didn't say a word, but several of the other girls began to murmur their congratulations. One said, "Aw," and another one said, "Boy or girl, Professor?" "A girl," he said. "Fanny, after Fanny Price."
"The Jewish vaudeville entertainer?"
someone tentatively asked. "No, Fanny Price from Mansfield Park," I corrected quietly. "Yes," said the professor, "that's right. Extra credit to the girl in blue." He looked at me gratefully, and I glanced slightly to the side, uneasy at having singled myself out. The girl in blue. My remark suddenly seemed so obviously vain and self-serving, and I could have slapped myself on the side of the head. But I had always been the kind of reader who marked up books and lent them out indiscriminately, knowing I'd never see them again, but wanting friends to read them and be as thrilled by them as I was. I'd owned 3 copies of Mansfield Park at one time or another. For some reason, I wanted him to know all of this about me. J. Castleman, M.A., brought from his pocket a small silver nutcracker, and then picked up a walnut. As quietly as possible, he began cracking nuts and eating them. Almost reflexively, He offered them to the class, but we all shook our heads and murmured no thanks. He simply ate for a few moments, then closed his eyes and ran his hands through his hair. "The thing is," Castleman finally said, "I always knew that when I had a baby it would have to be a literary name. I want my children to know how important books are. And I want all of you to know that, too," he said. "Because as you get older, life sort of eats away at you like battery acid, and all the things you once loved are suddenly harder to find. And when you do find them, you don't have time to enjoy them anymore, you know?" We didn't know, but we nodded somberly. "So, I named my baby Fanny," he went on. "And when you girls start to become baby machines in a few years, I expect all of you to name your little girls Fanny, too." There was uncomfortable laughter. None of us had any idea of what to make of him, though we knew we liked him. He stopped talking for a moment, taking time to crack a few more walnuts, and then, in a softer voice, he spoke a little about the writers he particularly loved. Dickens, Flaubert, Tolstoy, Chekhov, Joyce. "Joyce is it for me," he said. "I bow down before the genius shrine of Ulysses, of course, though I have to admit my heart really belongs to Dubliners. It doesn't get any better than the dead." Then Castleman said he was going to read to us from the final pages of The Dead. He produced a sea-green paperback copy of Dubliners, and as he read aloud we stopped twiddling our pencils and rotating the rings on our fingers, and yawning silently in that sluggish late afternoon way. Parts of the novella, particularly near the end, were stunning, and the room became absorbed and silent. His voice, as he read, was reverential. When he was done, he spoke for a few minutes about the meaning of the death of poor, doomed Michael Fury, who had stood lovesick in the frozen night in James Joyce's story, and died. "I would kill to write a story half as good. Literally kill," the professor said. "Well, okay, figuratively kill," he shook his head. "Because when I really face the facts, girls, I remember that I'll never even come close to doing what that man did." He paused, looking away self-consciously. Then he said, "Now comes the moment in which I have to confess that I'm trying to be a writer myself. I've written a few stories here and there. But for now," he went on quickly, "we're not supposed to be talking about me. We're supposed to be talking about literature." He pronounced the word archly, with humor, then looked around the room. "Who knows," he said. "Maybe one of you will write something truly great one day. The verdict isn't in yet." I understood that he was implying that for him, the verdict was in and it wasn't good. He continued to speak for a while longer, and the most diligent girls in the class took notes. I peered sidelong at Susan Whittle, the red-headed, blush-prone girl in mohair beside me. On a page of her binder, in perfectly formed letters, she had written, "Fiction equals art mixed with emotion!" exclamation, i.e., the novels of Virginia Woolf, James Joyce, etc., etc. "Experience should be undiluted. Similes!" exclamation, exclamation. "Note, must pick up streamers and keg today for soft mixer." Outside the tall windows of Seely Hall, the light was being wiped from the sky. I saw a few girls walking along the paths, but I didn't register them particularly. They were people walking, nothing more. I looked back at Professor Castleman. He was a new father with a wife and a baby lying in the warmth of the nursery of the local hospital. He was a sensitive, intelligent man with a suggestion of a limp. He'd most likely gotten it in Korea, I guessed, or else as a child, having survived polio. I imagined him 10 years old, trapped inside the cylinder of an iron lung, lying with only his head sticking out, while a kindly nurse read to him from Oliver Twist. The image was pitiful, made me almost want to cry for the poor boy whom I was starting to confuse in my mind with the character of Oliver Twist himself. I felt an uncomplicated love for Professor Castleman, and even a kind of love for his wife and tiny baby, the three points that made up this delicate Castleman constellation. When class ended, many of the girls tried to establish personal contact with the professor as though to say, "Yoo-hoo, over here!" It wasn't that they necessarily imagined him as their lover. He was already taken, after all. But even something about his being taken made the situation so much more exquisite. "Write what you know," he advised as he sent us off to complete our first writing assignment. That night after dinner, shepherd's pie, I remember, for I sat there looking at it and trying to describe it to myself in a writerly fashion, though the best I could come up with was, pathetically, "A roof of mashed potatoes spread thickly atop a squat house of meat." I climbed to the upper reaches of the Nielsen Library. On the tall steel shelves all around me were ancient bound volumes of scientific abstracts. Annals of Phytochemistry, September to November 1922. International Journal of Hematology, January to March 1931. I wondered if anyone would ever open any of these books again, or whether they'd remain shut for eternity, like some spell-fastened door in a fairy tale. Should I be the one to open them? To plant kisses on their frail, crisp pages and break the spell? Did it make any sense to try and write? What if no one ever read what I wrote? What if it languished untouched on the chilled shelf of a college library forever? I sat down at a carrel, looking around at the ignored spines of books, the light bulbs suspended in their little cages, and I listened to the distant scrapes of chair legs and the rumble of a lone book cart being rolled along one of the levels of stacks. For a while I stayed there and tried to imagine what it was I actually knew. I'd seen almost nothing of the world. A trip to Rome and Florence with my parents when I was 15 had been spent in the protection of good hotels and pinned behind the green glass windows of tour buses, looking at stone fountains and piazzas from an unreal remove. The level of my experience and knowledge had remained the same, hadn't risen, hadn't overflowed. I'd stood with other Americans, all of us huddled together, heads back and mouths dropped open as we peered up at painted ceilings. I thought now about how I'd never been entirely naked in front of a man, had never been in love, had never gone to a political meeting in someone's basement, had never really done anything that could be considered independent or particularly insightful or daring. At Smith, girls surrounded me, the equivalent of those American tourists. Girls in groups were safe as shepherd's pie. Now I sat in the upper part of the library, freezing cold but not minding. And finally I made myself begin to write something, without censoring it or condemning it for being trivial or narrow or simply poorly constructed. I wrote about the impenetrable wall of femaleness that formed my life. This, apparently, was what I knew. I wrote about the three different perfumes, Chanel No. 5, White Shoulders, and Joy, that could be smelled everywhere on campus, and about the sound of 600 female voices rising up together at convocation to sing Gaudiamus Igitur. When I was done, I sat for a long time at that carrel, thinking of Professor J. Castleman and how he'd looked in class with his eyes closed. His eyelids had had a purplish, nearly translucent quality, making them appear inadequate to the task of keeping the world out. Maybe that was what it was like to be a writer. Even with the eyes closed, you could see. During his office hours the following week, sitting on the bench in the hallway, I waited with nearly rabid anticipation. Someone was already in there. I could hear the dueling murmurs of a male voice and a female one, punctuated by an occasional shriek of female hilarity, all of which increased my annoyance. Was there a cocktail party going on? Were drinks being served in damp little sandwiches? Finally, the door opened and Abigail Brenner, one of the other students from the class, emerged, holding her tedious story about her grandmother's recent death from double pneumonia, which she had been reworking pointlessly since the first day of class. From within the office, I could see Castleman at his desk. His jacket was off, and he was in his shirt sleeves and tie. "Well, hello there, Miss Ames," he said, finally realizing I was there. "Hello, Professor Castleman," I said, and I sat across from him on a wooden chair. He held my new story in his hand, the one I'd left in his department mailbox.
"So, your story."
He looked at it serenely. There were almost no markings on it, no red pen hieroglyphics.
"I've read this twice, and frankly, both times I've found it to be wonderful."
Did he say this about everyone's story? Had he even said it about Abigail Bremer's dumb story about her grandmother? I didn't think so. It was my story that was good. I had written it for him, specifically wanting to please him, and apparently I'd succeeded. "Thank you," I said quietly, not meeting his eyes. "You barely know what I'm talking about now, am I right?" he asked me. "You have no conception of how good you are." "I love that about you, Miss Ames. It's a very touching quality. Please don't change." I nodded, embarrassed, and I understood that this was how he wanted to see me. Unusual but innocent, and I found that I didn't mind appearing this way. Maybe I thought it was even true. "Miss Ames, Miss Ames," he said, smiling, "what am I going to do with you?" I smiled back, beginning to feel at ease in this strange new role. "As my friend Laura would say," I told him, "maybe you should pickle me." Castleman folded his hands behind his head. "Well," he said slowly, "maybe your friend Laura has a point." Then the playful moment passed and we got to work, leaning together over my story. There was walnut on his breath, I noticed. "The trees bent back, as if in apprehension," he read aloud. He made a bunched-up face as though he'd eaten a bad nut. "I don't think so. Kind of phony, don't you think? You're better than that." "Well, yeah, I wasn't sure about that line," I said. And all of a sudden I knew it to be the worst line ever written in the history of student assignments. "You got carried away with your own voice there," Castleman said. "I did that myself when I was an undergraduate. Of course, unlike you, I had no reason to get carried away." "Oh, I'm sure you're a good writer," I assured him. "I don't know what I am, but I'm certainly not one of the naturals," he said. "I'm the type that sits there slaving away all day and thinking someone will give me credit for effort. But here's an important thing to remember, Miss Ames. In life, no one gives you credit for effort." There was a knock on the door, and Castleman quickly closed my short story, then said, "So when you're sitting up late at night agonizing over your work, just know that you have an admirer." "Thank you," I said. "And for God's sake," he said, "get rid of those apprehensive trees." I laughed in what I hoped was a knowing way, and then stood, taking the story from him. Our hands briefly touched, knuckle to knuckle. "Come in," he called out, and the door swung open and Susan Whittle, the red-headed girl from class, entered. Her skin, I'd noticed before, was so sensitive that all her reactions expressed themselves plainly on its surface. She seemed in a constant state of mortification. Even now a doily of pink spread down her neck. I, however, was entirely calm, as though I'd been given a horse tranquilizer. I glided from the office, past the other offices where students and professors bent solemnly together, past the bulletin boards with their flyers about summer programs in Rome and at Oxford, past the elderly English department secretary with her glass jar of hard candies. After that day, I felt peaceful in class, as if the imaginary horse tranquilizer had a long half-life. I was totally absorbed whenever Castleman spoke about literature or the craft of writing. He sat with his scatter of walnuts on the table, and he kept cracking the shells, picking the meat from the pried open lips and chewing while he spoke. One day he told the class that a talented lady writer would be giving a reading at the college the following week, and we were all required to attend. "They say she's very good," he says,
I've only read the first chapter of her novel. It's kind of bleak and disturbing for someone of the female persuasion, but I think she's terribly smart, and you all have to go. I'll be there with my attendance book, checking off names, so don't even think about skipping it. A few of the girls glanced at each other uneasily, actually seeming to believe his threat. The following Wednesday evening, I went to the reading room of the Nielsen Library to listen to Elaine Moselle. This was the first reading I'd ever attended, and the chairs were arranged informally. Someone from the English department gave a brief introduction, and then the writer, a big and blousy fair-haired woman with a purple scarf at her throat, stood at the podium. "This is from my novel, Sleeping Dogs," she said in one of those voices that seemed to have been extensively primed by alcohol and cigarettes. I recognized the timbre and admired it. Nobody I knew really talked like that. "I know most of you haven't read it," she went on, "because it's only sold 1,503 copies, despite so-called rave reviews. And most of those 1,503 copies," she went on, "were bought by my relatives, who were paid handsomely by me." There were a few uncertain laughs, including mine. Whatever her book was like, I wanted to admire it. This suddenly seemed to be an important goal, and when she began to read, I was relieved that, in fact, I could admire it. It was the story of a girl's sexual initiation on a farm in Iowa, and Elaine Moselle used graphic language about the way the new farmhand pushed himself into the girl as they lay together in the hayloft, with the animals grunting their approval below. The girl's point of view was represented, as well as the farmhand's. This wasn't a domestic novel by any means. It jumped outside the world of the girl's farm life and even graduated into some actual detailed facts about corn and soybeans and, very briefly, about the history of the John Deere Company. Contemporary novels by men often seemed to include Homeric catalogues of information, moving from the costs of things to what they felt like and tasted like. Land, sea, the difference between wheat and chaff. Elaine Moselle's novel was similar. Her carefully chosen words rolled out in that nicotined voice, and as she read aloud, she seemed to wake up the entire dreary room. She finished reading to great applause a solid hour later, and her face was flushed. Then she chug-a-lugged the glass of water on the podium, her lipstick scalloping its edge. Afterward, at the small reception, she stood in a corner of the room with its thin carpets and its old rust and sepia-colored globes, flanked by two faculty members, a man and a woman, and all three were talking in loud voices, though Elaine Moselle was the loudest of all, her voice rising up every so often in laughter and relief. She didn't have to perform any more tonight. She didn't have to stand there in front of us, talking about sex and irrigation. She didn't have to use the word thresher anymore. She was free again, and it showed in her bright eyes and now frankly red face. She was knocking back some whiskey, and while the other faculty members seemed to grow subtly drunk, Elaine Moselle became obviously so. I stood in a gawking cluster of girls from my creative writing class, all of us watching the novelist and the animated satellites around her. Professor Castleman had now become one of those satellites, and I saw him angle for a place at Elaine Moselle's elbow. She turned to him. They briskly shook hands. He whispered something into her hair, and then she laughed appreciatively and whispered something right back at him. I felt ridiculous standing at the side in my cardigan and tartan skirt. My skirt had one of those oversized gold safety pins stuck in it, and I suddenly wished I could pluck it out and jab myself in the eye with it. I wouldn't have approached her on my own, but now Professor Castleman saw me and beckoned, and soon he was introducing me to Elaine Moselle, telling her that I was an extremely promising young writer. She looked me over. I felt convinced that her eye went right to my stupid safety pin. "I'm better than I look," I wanted to say, cringing as I shook her big, hot hand. I told her how much I'd loved her reading, and that I planned to read the rest of her novel on my own.
"Good for you if you can find it," she said, I'm afraid you'll have to dig through lots of piles of loud male songs of innocence and experience. And then maybe you'll get to my little tale, buried at the bottom.
All around me, Castleman and the others protested, telling her how that wasn't true, that her novel was powerful in its own right and blah, blah, blah. Suddenly my professor said, "Oh, come on, Miss Moselle, it can't be as bad as all that."
"And how exactly would you know?"
she asked him. "Well," he said, "there are quite a few female novelists out there whom I admire greatly. Like those Southerners, that quilting bee made up of Flannery O'Connor and those others. Women whose work is inseparable from the region they inhabit."
As he spoke to her, I saw the looks exchanged, the dot-dash code between them, the cocking of her head, the way he leaned his elbow against a wall to appear casual, the way both of them were interested in each other, and the rest of the faculty members and students stood in a docile ring around them, like people singing the parts of villagers in an opera and stepping back to let the two principal players have their moment. She was bitter and difficult, a once good-looking woman who had gotten a little too heavy and shouldered too much resentment to attract many people anymore. And yet Professor Castleman was taken with her. Maybe he was repelled by her, too. But still he was attracted. She was gifted. Her gifts were strange and discomforting and sort of male. She was one of those angry women, this Elaine Moselle. Angry because her novel had sold 1,503 copies, and because she understood how talented she really was, but that it might never really matter.
"Listen," she was saying now, "Flannery O'Connor is a genius, and I mean no disrespect to her, but she's also something of a freak of nature, so visionary and devoutly Catholic and stern."
"She's an important writer," one of the other men insisted. "I teach her every year in my course on the grotesque. She's the only woman on the list. There's really no one like her."
"But Miss Flannery O'Connor has something going for her that I don't," Elaine continued. "Her southernness gives her this ready-made, colorful region to write about, and for some reason, it always seems so incredibly exotic to people."
She paused and let one of the men fill her glass again.
"The public likes to hear about the crazy old South, and they certainly may admire Southern women writers," she continued. "But they don't want to know them, you know? Because they're strange creatures, O'Connor and that squirrely little Andrew Jean Carson McCullers. I don't want to be a strange creature. I guess I just want to be loved."
She took a deep drink and then added,
"You know, I wish I was a lesbian. I really do."
There were murmurs of protest again.
"You don't mean that,"
I heard a timid female dean say, but Elaine Moselle overrode her.
"Oh, anyway, I do," she said. "The problem is that I love men passionately, even though they don't deserve it. But if I happened to be one of those literary lesbians, I wouldn't give a goddamn about what the rest of the world thought of me, or whether it even thought of me at all."
There was more response, more talk, and eventually the others turned away. The night was growing late, and I could see the janitors waiting outside the room with their mops, and I stood crumpling a Smith-crested paper cocktail napkin in my hand, also waiting. Though what I was waiting for was obscure to me. Elaine Moselle saw me waiting, and suddenly she took me by my arm, pulling me aside into a small alcove so quickly I couldn't even express surprise.
"You're talented, I hear," she said.
"Well, maybe," I began.
"Don't do it," she said.
No one else heard this. We were surrounded only by marble busts of commendable long-dead women. "Don't do what?"
"Don't think you can get their attention," she said.
"Whose?" She looked at me sadly, impatiently, as if I were an idiot. An idiot with a safety pin plunged into her skirt.
"The men," she said. "The men who write the reviews, who run the publishing houses, who edit the papers and magazines, who decide who gets to be taken seriously, who gets put up on a pedestal for the rest of their lives, who gets to be king shit.
So you're saying it's a conspiracy? I asked gently.
If you use that word, it makes me appear envious and insane,
Elaine Moselle went on,
which I'm not. Yet. But, yes, I guess you could call it a conspiracy to keep the women's voices hushed and tiny, and the men's voices loud.
She raised up her own voice on this last word. Oh, I see, was all I could say, vaguely.
Don't do it, she said again. Find some other way. There's only a handful of women who get anywhere. Short story writers mostly, as if maybe women are somehow more acceptable in miniature.
Maybe, I tried. Women are different from men. Maybe they try to do different things when they write.
Yes, said Elaine. That could be true. But the men with their big canvases, their big books that try to include everything in them, their big suits, their big voices are always rewarded more. They're the important ones, and you want to know why?
She leaned closer and said,
because they say so.
Then she abruptly left me, and I walked back to my dormitory, but all night I felt sickish, restless. As it would turn out, Elaine Moselle's writing wouldn't last. Her novel would go out of print and would never be reprinted. It would disappear, becoming a curiosity, the sort of moldy, obscure title that people buy for 25 cents at a tag sale on the side of a road in Vermont, and then put on the shelf of their guest room. But no guest ever actually takes it down to read. I've occasionally wondered what became of Elaine Moselle, because after Sleeping Dogs, I don't believe she ever published another novel. Maybe it was too hard for her. Maybe she got married and had children, and life intruded and there was simply no time for her work. Maybe she became an alcoholic. Maybe every publisher turned down her manuscripts. Maybe she had no more books left inside her, as people often sorrowfully say about writers, envisioning the imagination as a big pantry, either well stocked with goods or else wartime empty. Maybe she died. I never found out, for her novel joined the vast rolling graveyard of unloved books. And perhaps she threw herself on top of the grave, inconsolable. One day, a month into the semester, having had 3 conferences with Professor Castleman during office hours, each one held aloft by his elaborate praise, he called my name at the end of class and I walked up to him, brimming, steadying myself. "Miss Ames, I wanted to ask you something," he said. "Would you walk out with me and we can talk?" I nodded, seeing the way the others took note of this moment. One of them, Rochelle Darton, whose short stories featured inevitable surprise endings.
"Just like O. Henry,"
Rochelle had explained in her own defense. Sighed as she shrugged into her coat, watching student and teacher lingering together, as though she knew that she would never be asked to walk out with Professor Castleman, that she would never be asked to linger, to loiter, to give more of herself than she already did. I thought Castleman might be about to tell me that he was nominating me for a $100 college literary prize. Or maybe I thought he wanted to ask me to have dinner with him, to go out on a clandestine date, the way a girl who lived on my hall had done with her chemistry professor. I wasn't sure which it would be, art or love. But with someone like Jay Castleman, love of art could transform quickly into human love, couldn't it? I hoped this was true, but was immediately mortified by my own thoughts, which seemed both delusional and deeply corrupt. We'd arrived at the middle of the campus when he said to me, "I was wondering, Miss Ames, whether by any chance you're free Saturday night." I told him I was. All around us, girls trudged past. Good, he said. Would you be interested in babysitting? My wife and I haven't gotten out since Fanny was born. Sure, I said flatly. I love children, which wasn't even true. I felt a flush of humiliation about what I'd imagined, and how different the truth was, but still, this was better than nothing, better than being ignored by him. So on Saturday night, I declined to attend Northrop House's big band party, walking away from the sounds of String of Pearls cranked loud on a phonograph, and the parry of male voices in the snapping air, and instead headed along Elm Street until it shook off its collegiate feel and became simply part of a neighborhood where families lived. Bancroft Road was dark, with no street lamps, and I could see into front windows where faculty members and their wives and children shuffled around living rooms. Was this the epiphany of adult life? That it actually wasn't exciting and vast in possibilities, but was in fact as enclosed and proscribed as childhood? What a disappointment. For I'd been looking forward to the open field, the imagined release. Or maybe, I thought, as I watched a young mother stride across her living room, then suddenly stoop down to pick something up. A shoe? A squeak toy? Only men ever felt that release. For women in 1956 were always confronting boundaries, negotiations, where they could walk at night, how far they could let a man go when the two of them were alone. Men hardly seemed troubled by these things. They walked everywhere in cold, dark cities and pin-drop empty streets, and they let their hands go walking, too, and they opened their belts and then their trousers, and they never thought to themselves, I must stop this right now. I must not go any further. Here on Bancroft Road it appeared that I was in a land in which everyone seemed to have stopped themselves from going too far. This was Smith, not Harvard. Prestigious, but not of high academic voltage. The men who held these faculty positions would initially feel relief at being here, and would settle in for the long run. But something would probably steal over them eventually. A desire to move on, to burst out into bigger cities, to not waste their PhDs and carefully composed lectures on girls who would dutifully absorb everything and then immediately go get married and reproduce, inevitably beginning the long process of forgetting. The Castleman house was a gray salt box, set back from the street behind a bumpy lawn. The bell on the front porch made a half-hearted blat when I pressed it. In a moment, Professor Castleman himself was at the door, lit from behind by a yellow bulb. "You must be freezing," he said as he let me in. He wore a half-opened dress shirt, an unknotted tie draped around his neck. "I'm warning you, it's chaos here," he said. He smelled of some sort of shaving balm, and a spot of blood was on his chin. The record album from South Pacific was playing distantly, and from somewhere behind him a baby rhythmically cried, and then a woman's voice called out, "Joe? Joe, could you come up?" His name was Joe. I hadn't known this, and I'd been afraid to attach a specific first name to him. His wife descended, carrying the baby over her shoulder. I lifted my eyes to look. The baby was quiet now, though bright red in the face. Mrs. Castleman wasn't beautiful. She was a small, frazzled woman in her middle 20s with boyish brown hair and darting eyes. What did he see in her? I imagined my professor in bed with this unglamorous little woman. Mrs. Castleman was so different from the Smith girls who grazed all around the campus like gazelles nibbling foliage. She stood with her hand reaching up the back of the baby's outfit to check the status of a diaper. And she gave the appearance of a puppeteer in that moment, the hand inside the cloth, the baby entirely under her power, at least for now. "Hello," Castleman's wife said without much interest. "I'm Carol Castleman, nice to meet you." I tried to appear neutral, cheerful, a Smithy straight out of a college brochure. Autumn leaves should have been falling all around me as I stood at the foot of the uncarpeted staircase. "You too," I said. "Hello, honey. I forced myself to say in the general direction of the baby. Aren't you adorable? We haven't left her with a sitter before, Mrs. Castleman explained. But she's still so young I can't imagine it'll scar her for life, regardless of what I've been trained to think. The professor's wife shifted the baby to her other arm and explained, I'm studying to be a psychoanalyst.